This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You know the no man's land where Al-Qaeda and the Taliban have found a safe haven on the border of Pakistan and Afghanistan? An area off limits to everyone else? Journalist Dexter Filkins managed to get in there and interview a Taliban commander. That's one of the stories he's about to tell us, a story which will demonstrate both his courage and insight. Filkins joined us several times to talk about the war in Iraq, which he covered for the New York Times between 2003 and 2006. After that, he spent a year as a fellow at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. He's received a George Polk Award and two Overseas Press Club Awards. His recent book, The Forever War, is based on the 561 notebooks he filled during 9 years of reporting from the Middle East and South Asia. Dexter Filkins, welcome back to Fresh Air. You've been reporting from Afghanistan, and it's a place you know. You have, in your book, The Forever War, you have a chapter early on that's based on your reporting from Afghanistan back in 1998. And the chapter starts with you witnessing a Taliban execution in a stadium. And when the execution is over, people stream onto the field as if it were a baseball game. Is it kind of sickening for you to watch the Taliban resurgence in Afghanistan?
Yeah, it is, actually, and particularly because I don't think, or I didn't get the impression when I was there, that they're really all that popular. As somebody said to me when I was there, we've seen the Taliban movie before, and I think they have. And that Taliban movie is, you know, public executions and amputations and particularly, but overall, really, really harsh, heavy-handed rule. And a really draconian form of Islam, which, frankly, a lot of the Afghans don't really share. And so, I think the one of the more unusual things that I saw when I was there was that even where the Taliban were strong and where there were a lot of them, I didn't have an overwhelming sense that they were all that popular. And I think what that meant, at least for me, I mean, the lesson that I took from it was that the Taliban were rushing into a vacuum.
You say that the people in Afghanistan say, we've seen this movie before, the Taliban. We've seen this movie before. But this is kind of like the sequel. So I'm wondering how the sequel is different from the post-Soviet movie of the Taliban. You know, when the Taliban took over after the Soviets left Afghanistan, is the leadership the same? Are the goals the same? Is their style the same?
No, that's a good question. I think they have changed. The leadership is the same. I mean, it's Mullah Omar, same guy as before, sitting in Pakistan. He's in Quetta almost certainly. I think they're a little different. I mean, if you look at Afghanistan today, and particularly Kabul, the capital, you know, there's I don't know how many TV stations there are, newspapers, women walking around. The internet cafes all over the place. I mean, that's a totally different world. That's the modern world, and it's not like that everywhere in Afghanistan. But a lot of Afghans have had experience with modernity since 1998 when I was there before. People have gone abroad, they've come back. You know, they watch foreign TV shows and movies all the time. You know, they get on the internet. It's not maybe not so much that the Taliban has changed, but I think they'd have a much more difficult time imposing the fourth century rule that they did before, because the rest of the country is no longer in the fourth century.
Well, over the summer, you took a pretty extraordinary journey. You went to part of the tribal area in that borderland between Afghanistan and Pakistan, where the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and other Islamist groups have basically a safe haven. Journalists are not welcome in that area. Journalists yeah. don't go there on the whole. How did you get in?
Oh, my God. A lot of work. I went in, as you said, I went into the tribal areas, which is this very remote place in Pakistan. It really is where, I mean, if there were a CIA agent on the show here, he'd say that's where Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri are. The Taliban completely control it, and they've you know begun moving out of it into the rest of Pakistan. And, of course, from there they've been sending fighters into Afghanistan to fight the Americans. And Western journalists are definitely not welcome there. They're not welcome there by the Taliban, and they're not welcome there by the Pakistani government. it took me weeks, let's put it that way. I found some local people who I trusted, some local Pakistanis, and it's the way everything works in that part of the world. You know, they knew somebody who had a cousin who knew somebody who had another cousin, and they got me in and they got me out. And so I went in. I mean, it was very, very elaborate, and it took me several weeks to arrange, but I was able to go in to the tribal areas. I met and sat for most of a day with a Taliban commander, one of the local warlords who was sending suicide bombers across into Afghanistan. I sat with him in his house for most of the day, and I got out alive. And it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy. And I'm not sure, honestly, if I went there today, if I could do it again, or even that I would do it again, frankly.
Tell us about some of the things you saw.
Well, I mean, I'll just paint you a picture of Haji Namdar, the late Haji Namdar, I should say. He's now dead, the Taliban commander that I met with. I went in to see him, and I remember, I mean, just the most bizarre thing about it really was I was sitting in Peshawar, which is the big city in northwest Afghanistan. It's outside of the tribal areas, and I was there for about a month trying to arrange this trip, and I finally, you know, as I got closer to getting in and getting permission from Haji Namdar to come and see him, the Pakistani military launched this great offensive into the tribal areas. And there was, you know, it was on the TV news. It was big headlines in the newspaper, you know, Pakistan Army mounts final offensive against Taliban militants. And there were, you know, film clips and photos and the whole thing. And I remember the day I finally went in and I just drove in. I mean, I didn't have anybody's permission. And I hired a bunch of armed guards, all of whom I think were related to the guy who was translating for me. But as we drove in, I realized very quickly that there was no offensive by the Pakistani military. I didn't see – I was there a whole day. I drove all the way to the Afghan border. I didn't see a single police officer. I didn't see a single Pakistani soldier. The offensive was ostensibly aimed at the warlord who I was visiting, and I visited him in his house, and I sat with him all day. And I remember as I mean, this struck me as I was driving in, and I went in and as I sat down on the floor with Haji Namdar, I said to him, "Gee, I've been reading about this offensive. I thought they were coming after you." And he laughed. He was actually a very warm guy for all his brutality. And he said, "Oh, it's just theater." And I said, "Theater for who?" And he said, "For the Americans."
Is that the general impression of a lot of Pakistan's efforts to go after al-Qaeda and the Taliban, that it's theater, that they're not really serious about it? I know some people call it catch and release, like you round up the usual suspects, keep them in jail a few days, and then let them go.
That's probably – I mean, that's a huge part of it. I think it's hard to say any one thing about Pakistan and have it be true across the board. I mean, there's so many – that country is so complex and it's so labyrinthine and it's such a house of mirrors that there's so many different things that are happening at the same time, many of which are contradict each other. And so, for instance, I think undoubtedly probably the Prime Minister of Pakistan and the chief of the army staff and the guys at the top, when the Americans come and as they often do and they pound on the table and they say, "Go after the Taliban, you know, go after them, they're threatening your government." I think they do. I think they try. And I think there's elements of the Pakistani military that also do that. But there's also elements of the Pakistani military and the intelligence services that don't. And so trying to sort out which guys are straight and which ones aren't, and which things are working and which aren't. I mean, there's also a large element of total incompetence in a lot of this. I mean, the Pakistani army just isn't very good. But that's really that's the riddle. And I think anybody who's spent a lot of time in the country will tell you the same thing. It's just so hard to figure out there what's true and what's not.
The Taliban leader who you interviewed was a commander who was also the head of the Vice and Virtue Brigade. What was his house like? What kind of sense did you get of his lifestyle?
Well, Haji Namdar. I'll tell you a quick story about Haji Namdar. I remember as I was getting ready to go in and meet him, the Pakistanis that I was working with who were working very hard to get me in to see him, they said to him at one point, they said, you know, you should really bring Haji Namdar a gift. We think that would be a really good idea. And so I said, fine, just go out and buy something for him. You know, anything that you think is appropriate, just tell me how much it was and I'll pay for it. So my guys went out and they bought Haji Namdar a 2-volume set of the Quran, as if, you know, he didn't have any. And we got some purple – we got some really nice purple wrapping paper and we wrapped it up. And so we went in as we got in that day and as we drove in and we went up to Haji Namdar's house, and which was surrounded by these, you know, Taliban fighters, I guess average age 15. But as we went in and sat down on the floor of his house and started to chat, I took out the 2-volume set wrapped in purple, and I gave it to him. I said, you know, I have a gift for you. And he said, oh, that's so nice of you. I have a gift for you. And so he gave me a gift. So we both unwrapped our gifts at the same time. And, of course, I gave him a Quran, and when I opened my present, I realized it was a Quran also. So we'd given each other Qurans. But
you probably had fewer of them at home than he did.
It's true. It was in English. He said, you know, you should read this. But he was actually I told you when I went in to see him that I said to him, I thought there was a big military offensive against you. And he said, oh, it's all theater. Well, I kept pressing him on that. And I said, tell me what's going on here, because I thought the Pakistani military was coming after you. They say they're coming after you. And then he said at one point, and this was after a long discussion in which he had described for me how he sent fighters across the border and how they trained suicide bombers and the whole thing. And I said to him, look, I'm just trying to understand again this Pakistani military offensive. You know, what's going on? And he said to me, look, I'm safe. I'm fighting the jihad, so they leave me alone. And I think that was largely true. I mean, I think that as best as I could determine the deal, whether it was stated or unstated, I think it was probably stated more often than not, was with, and I mean the deal between the Pakistani government and the militants in the tribal areas. And the deal has been you can send people across the border to fight the Americans. We don't have a problem with that. Just don't come into our backyard and make trouble. You do what you want across the border. Just don't come into Islamabad. Don't come into the capital and start making trouble. And that, I think, historically has been the deal for the, you know, in the 7 years that the United States has been fighting there. I think that deal has begun to break down. But I think that's the deal. You fight the jihad, we leave you alone.
That's unfortunate, since the United States has given so much money to the Pakistani government and military to help the United States fight the war on terror. And if the Pakistani government is basically saying to the terrorists, well, just leave our government alone and do what you will elsewhere, it's not very helpful to the United States.
It's not. And that's, I mean, you mentioned the money. I mean, it's, you know, $8 billion, I think, roughly, that the United States has given to the Pakistani government. But I think what's interesting and what's happening now, and it was actually happening when I was there, the deal has begun to break down. And that's changing everything. I mean, the deal again was you can go across, you can send fighters in to kill Americans, but don't bring them into the rest of Pakistan. That's changed. The Pakistani government, this has taken up over the past year and a half. Remember, the Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto was killed. You had the Marriott Hotel. Mm-hmm. My gosh, I spent months in that hotel that was, you know, blown up by a suicide bomber. It was a wave of suicide bombings last year. That's basically what's happened. And I think the best comparison really is sort of Frankenstein. I mean, it's you know, the Pakistani military helped create the Taliban. They kept them alive in the tribal areas. They've nurtured them. They've trained them. They've helped them do the things that they want to do. Frankenstein has gotten out of control. He's gotten up off the table, and he's now coming into the rest of Pakistan. And now the Taliban has avowedly declared, and they've made it very clear in their actions, that they intend to go outside of the tribal areas and into the rest of Pakistan. And that's – you're seeing that happening. So it's kind of – it's I think the best way – I mean, it's impossible to look or to even talk about Afghanistan and the war in Afghanistan without also talking about Pakistan. And the two are – you can just see how linked the two are. And basically what it is the region on the border. It's about 45 million people. You could call it Pashtunistan. That's what they call it. It's the ethnic Pashtuns on both sides of the border. And that's the real problem. Part of that is in Afghanistan. Part of it's in Pakistan.
And this is that border area we were talking about where the Taliban and al-Qaeda have a kind of safe haven.
Yes, absolutely.
My guest is Dexter Filkins, and he's been reporting for the New York Times from Afghanistan and Pakistan. He reported on the war in Iraq for 4 years and is the author of the book The Forever War. Now, we were talking about how you went into the no-man's land, the borderland between Afghanistan and Pakistan, where the Taliban and al-Qaeda have safe haven. And among other things, you interviewed a Taliban commander there who's the head of the Vice and Virtue Squad. And just a few weeks after you interviewed him, he was killed, not by the Pakistani military, but the person suspected of organizing his murder was another Taliban commander. What do you have any understanding of why?
Well, you have to – it's anarchy in that part of the world. It's a state of nature. There's no government, Pakistani or Afghan. There's nothing. There's no rule of law. So it's basically a bunch of warlords competing for power. So yes, they attack American soldiers and yes, they send suicide bombers into the rest of Pakistan. But they're also – you know, jockeying for power and position among themselves. And I remember when I went in to see Haji Namdar, the first thing he said to me was, he kind of laughed and said, he said, my friend, this is after weeks of arranging, going in to see him in the tribal areas. And he said, my friend, you have to be very careful who you come in here into the tribal areas to meet. He said, if I were Batula Masood, I would cut your head off. And then we sat down and had a nice conversation. But I think it was from what my best understanding is that the person who killed him was Batula Masood. And Batula Masood is based in another part of the tribal areas. He's probably the single most powerful Taliban commander in the area. He's kind of claimed a sovereignty over the area. He's formed a large umbrella group with various warlords. And Haji Namdar, the guy I met, was very vocal about not joining his group. He said, I'm independent. I'm my own guy. And so a few weeks after I left, he was killed.
Haji Namdar made a good point when he said if he were this other commander, he'd take your head off. And in the post-Daniel Pearl era, how worried are you about meeting a Taliban commander in a remote area?
I was pretty worried. It's pretty risky. It's not something that, I got in and got out, and I'm very happy to be able to say that. It was pretty dangerous because a lot of people have gone in to meet Taliban commanders, and bad things have happened to them. I felt pretty comfortable in this place, in this case, because I had worked with some local Pakistani guys, and I really felt like I could trust him. And at the end of the day, that's all it comes down to. It comes down to trust, and it comes down to your gut and how you feel. But even then, I trusted these guys, and they hired a bunch of armed guards, and we went in together. Something could have gone wrong. I mean, even if I trusted everybody and kind of everybody was on the up and up. I remember we had to, for example, to get to Haji Namdar's place, we had to drive through the territory of another warlord, a guy named Mongol Bagh, who's one of the bigger Taliban commanders there. And we had to pay kind of a tribute to Mongol Bagh just so we could drive across his territory. Now, nothing went wrong. I got in. I went and saw Haji Namdar. We went to the Afghan border. I got out. Very lucky.
One of the things that the Taliban commander Haji Namdar told you, and I thought this was kind of interesting, is that they set a minimum age for suicide bombers because yeah. They realized it was morally wrong to send children who were too young to do the task. How did he explain that to you?
It's kind of a humanitarian gesture.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like entering another universe when you sit down with somebody like Haji Namdar. I mean, none of the old rules apply, but they were, they felt very comfortable about what they're doing. I mean, that's why they do it. So it never occurred to them there was anything wrong with sending suicide bombers into Afghanistan. So we had kind of a very, we had a lengthy discussion about it. And he said, I just want you to know, we're not bloodthirsty people. He said, We have, for example, we have so many people come to us and say, we want to go across. I want to go across and do a martyrdom operation. I want to blow myself up. I want to be a suicide bomber. And he said, we get so many people. And he said, you know, so many young people, you know, and they come here and they're 12 years old. And we send them home. And we think, you know, 15 years old, that's a good age. But until then, you're really too young to make up your mind about this. This is, you know, serious stuff.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with New York Times foreign correspondent Dexter Filkins. He's been reporting from Pakistan and Afghanistan. He covered the war in Iraq from 2003 to 2006. His book about his experiences and observations covering Afghanistan, Iraq, and the war on terror is called The Forever War. Now, you've been reporting most recently from Afghanistan. And President Obama has just deployed 17,000 more troops to Afghanistan. Do you feel like the American soldiers you met in Afghanistan were better prepared for what they're facing than the soldiers who initially went into Iraq, not expecting the kind of insurgency that they encountered?
Yes, that's a very good question. To mention Iraq, I remember when I went in 2003, 2004, seems like so long ago. In everything kind of went wrong in the beginning, and one of the things that primarily went wrong was the American military, and they're happy to talk about this themselves. They prosecuted the war in entirely the wrong way. They would go into these villages in the Sunni Triangle, and I mean, I watched these things with my own eyes. They'd get hit with a suicide bombing or a car bombing or an IED or something. They'd go into a village. They'd kick down every door in the village. They'd pull everybody out of their beds at 4 o'clock in the morning. They'd, you know, cuff the young men, all the young men between 15 and 35, and take them away. And so maybe they'd find the suicide bomber or the guy making the IED, but they created enemies. I mean, they made enemies. And that's what happened in Iraq. And the military has completely changed. I mean, you can really see kind of the learning curve. They've changed totally in Iraq, and they've changed in Afghanistan. So you can see I went on some foot patrols with some soldiers in southern Afghanistan, and as we went into these tiny villages, it was really remarkable. I mean, you know, these are just kids, you know. These are just 19 and 20-year-olds, and the guys, these couple of guys that I was walking around with, there was a guy named Lieutenant James Holloway and another lieutenant named Brian James. And they were 24 years old, I think, and they were very, very sophisticated about the way they went about. And we walked into these villages, and the whole goal is not to find and kill and capture Taliban. That's not the goal. You know, that's a kind of incidental thing. The goal is to befriend and to protect the civilians and thereby separate them from the insurgency.
One of the strategies, I mean, probably the most winning strategy that the United States military used in Iraq was the awakening, paying militia leaders basically to join our team to work for our side against the insurgents,
right,
as opposed to
right,
working with the insurgents. That's something I believe is being tried in a kind of small-scale experimental version in Afghanistan. Now, what's your sense so far about whether that model might be effective in Afghanistan?
That's a good question. Just to talk about Iraq for a second, you're absolutely right. The awakening, I mean, essentially what you got with the Sunni awakening was over the course of about 6 months to 6 to 12 months, you had about 90% of the insurgency change sides and come on the American payroll. And you know, it's ugly, it's improbable, it's fragile, it's all those things. But the violence has come down 90%. In some areas, so it's a strange thing to witness. It really is, particularly up close. But it's probably the single most important factor in bringing the violence down in that country. And so I think the lesson that you take away from that is, and somebody like General Petraeus, if he were here, would say this. He said it publicly many times. You can't kill and capture your way out of a big insurgency. You can't do it. And what does that mean? Well, how do you prevail? Well, you make friends. I think that's the idea that something like that can be done in Afghanistan. I think it's going to be a lot harder in Afghanistan. I think the U.S. military knows that themselves. And the reason for that is if you just take Iraq, essentially what happened in Iraq, Iraq is still largely, particularly among the Sunnis, it's a tribal society. So if you sit down with, Abu Hatem, the big leader of the Dulaimi tribe in Anbar province in western Iraq, and you have a big bag of money with you and you say, Abu Hatem, let's make a deal. Abu Hatem can deliver his tribe. You know, he can make a deal. He can say, he can sort of take the big bag of money and then pass out some of it and call his cousins and the other tribal leaders. And so something like a deal can sort of stick. I don't know that you can really do that in Afghanistan in the same way. Afghanistan still is a tribal society, but this is a country that has been at war for 30 years, and it's been decimated and atomized in every way that you can imagine. And so that the old tribal networks have been completely attenuated. They don't really function in the same way anymore. And so the kind of normal bonds that hold that society together have been broken. So what does that leave you with? Well, it leaves you with kind of not very much, and there's not very much to work with. I mean, it's the reason for the success of the Taliban. They're very coherent. They stick together. They're violent. And so I think the idea in Afghanistan is, can we try to duplicate the awakening in some way? And it's going to be really hard, I think.
You went back to Iraq early in the fall, and I wonder if you know if the militia leaders who were part of the awakening, who were on the American military payroll, are still on that payroll. Or are we still paying them? And when do the payments stop?
Well, the short answer is I think the Iraqi government has taken over the payroll. They're paying them now. I mean, we're standing over their shoulder, but it's Iraqi money now. But look, as I said, I think it's fragile and it's really ugly. But to answer your question, it was just extraordinary to see this up close, the awakening. It really just amazing. I mean, you can literally sit across the table, as I did, across the table from guys who, 18 months before were blowing up Humvees and killing Americans. And now they're working for us. And they're working well for us. It's incredible. And I remember they all said pretty much the same thing, which is whatever. I was a member of the Iraqi army in 2002 and 2003. The Americans came in, they got everything wrong. They broke all the furniture. They dismantled the army. I joined the insurgency. I spent the next, 4 years killing Americans. And then along came Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda emerged as probably the smallest part, but absolutely the most violent part of the insurgency. And they didn't want to just kill Americans. They wanted to kill Shiites. They wanted to kill government officials. They wanted to blow up mosques. They wanted to do suicide bombings. Your average Iraqi insurgent, say whatever else you want to say about them, didn't want to do that. They wanted to kill Americans. And so they started to get squeezed, as they described it. They started to get squeezed by Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda started killing them. And so what happened really was the awakening, the phenomenon of the awakening, was they had Al-Qaeda on one side, who they were now under extreme pressure. And then on the other side, they had the Iraqi government, which, frankly, was employing a lot of death squads. This is kind of 05, 06, 07. They needed friends, and the Americans needed friends, and so they found each other.
There isn't quite a parallel now in Afghanistan, right?
No, well, maybe. I mean, maybe there are some parallels. I wouldn't say they would be exact. I mean, I think the principal difference is the awakening. The awakening came to us in Iraq. We didn't create it. They basically, it's a bunch of tribal leaders who were involved in the insurgency and came to the American officers and said, look, let's make a deal.
I thought it was the other way around. I didn't realize that.
Maybe it's more accurate to say it was a mutual negotiation. I mean, they were always in contact with one another. But this wasn't something that was ordered up by the United States. You had a huge part of the Iraqi insurgency, a huge part of Sunni society in Iraq that was sick of the war and sick of the fighting and sick of Al-Qaeda in particular, and was looking for a way out, and they found it. And so some of those things are true in Afghanistan, but some of them, and I think probably the most important ones, aren't. The first one is Afghanistan, the tribal networks in Afghanistan, as I said, are just kind of very attenuated. It's not like we've been approached by all these Afghan tribal leaders who have said, gee, we want to make a deal. We're kind of trying to do this and take the initiative and do it on our own. I do think, and I think there's some reason for hope here. I could be completely wrong about this, but the sense I got when I went into these villages, these tiny places, was that the Taliban weren't that popular. And so the Taliban were operating and they were strong in places primarily where there weren't any troops, you know, or even the places we'd go in on a foot patrol. And we went into this village called Sopsai. You know, maybe we'd go back in a week. You know, well, what happens on the other 6.5 days? You know, the Taliban have a free run of the place. And so I think the attempt to create these local militias, and it is just a pilot program in Wardak province, is a sort of – somebody described it to me as a thickening. You know, if we can sort of make the security forces, the Afghan security forces, stronger than they are. We can sort of put guns in people's hands who want to resist the Taliban, and maybe they'll do it. Now, I think the danger is maybe they won't. You know, maybe they'll do other things with those guns. And that is kind of the danger, I think, the big danger. But that's the idea.
So one of the things you hear about a lot from everybody who has been to Afghanistan, at least everybody I've spoken to, is that there's so much corruption that you have to yeah. you have to bribe your way in and out of everything. And yes. Was that your experience?
Yeah, it's unbelievable. It's so corrupt. It's just mind-boggling. Yeah, it's the most corrupt place I've ever been in. I mean, most governments in the third world are corrupt, but not like this.
Do you have a favorite example of a bribe?
Well, I mean, my bag got lost when I went to the wrong country or something, and so I had to go back to the airport to get it. And I was walking into the airport, and I was stopped by a police officer who said, "You can't go inside." And I paid a bribe to go into the airport. It wasn't much. It was a couple bucks or something. But that's the level of corruption. It starts at the top, goes all the way to the bottom, so that everything is for sale. And so at the top of the government, you have President Karzai's brothers who've been implicated in the opium trade extensively. And all the way down at the bottom, you have police officers charging money for you just to do things like going to the airport. Another quick example, the photographer I was working with, he was taking pictures of something, I don't know, that he wasn't supposed to take pictures of. I think it was actually houses that had been built by corrupt officials. And he was arrested, and they were taking him to the police station, and they said, look, we'll forget the whole thing if you give us whatever, you know, 20 bucks. The amounts are usually pretty small. He paid a bribe to get out of – to kind of be unarrested. So it's just everywhere.
And can you expense this to the New York Times?
I did not expense the bribe to go into the airport. No.
So, you know, a lot of people say that it's Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, who's kind of setting the tone for this corruption, that he runs a corrupt government and the corruption kind of filters up and filters down. He's up for election soon. His term expires in May, but the election has been postponed until August. Do you get the sense that the Obama administration will try to influence the outcome of the election in any way? I think it's fair to say the Obama administration is very skeptical about Hamid Karzai as a good, forward-looking, non-corrupt leader of the country.
Yeah, I don't think they're very happy with Karzai. I don't think anyone is. But I think the question is whether there's an alternative to him, and it's not really clear that there is. His government is, as I said, completely corrupt. He's kind of lost control of it. He's kind of the mayor of Kabul. I mean, you've got this enormous country that really outside of the city limits, he doesn't really have any control over or much control. And as I said, his brothers have been implicated pretty extensively in the opium trade, which is now the world's largest. I mean, I think it's 90% of the world's opium is grown in southern Afghanistan now, and it, you know, provides $300 million a year for the Taliban. And so all these things are kind of bound up together. I think the Americans would probably love, you know, if some very credible, popular candidate suddenly stood up and was ready to take over. I don't think anyone's seen that person yet. And So I think there's a lot of worry about what comes next. I think what concerns me is there's a sense of frustration among ordinary Afghans with how corrupt and ineffectual his government is. And I think if say President Karzai were to be reelected to another 5-year term, which would make it 12 years in office altogether, almost 13, I think there'd be a lot of frustration. I mean, even if he won a popular election, I mean, it is going to be an election. But I think people are very, very frustrated with him. And I think what bothers me is that people would lose hope if unless they get a change.
Now, are you going to be going back to Afghanistan soon?
I don't know yet. Maybe Pakistan.
Why Pakistan and not Afghanistan?
Well, I just am interested in it. As I said, I think in some ways, it's the bigger problem and the bigger story. Mm-hmm. 175 million people. Think of that. It's imploding. It's a failed state on the northwestern side, and it's got nuclear weapons. It's really, really a big problem. I don't know that it's really solvable. You know, people talk about what can the Americans do, what levers can they pull. I don't know that the Americans can do that much. How much influence does any country have? And if they can't save it, it's gonna be pretty remarkable.
Well, Dexter Filkins, thanks for coming back to Fresh Air. It's always great to talk with you.
Thank you very much.
Dexter Filkins is a foreign correspondent for the New York Times. His book is called The Forever War. War and the economy have given us plenty of reasons to not feel in a particularly celebratory mood. So I'm glad that my next guests created an occasion to celebrate with a special bottle of wine. They call it Open That Bottle Night, and its 10th anniversary is this Saturday. Dorothy Gator and John Brecher are the husband and wife team who write the Wall Street Journal wine column called Tastings. Dorothy Gator, John Brecher, welcome back to Fresh Air. Why don't you explain what Open That Bottle Night is?
When we started our column more than a decade ago, we found that the question that people asked us over and over again was the same question. I have this one special bottle of wine. It came from my grandmother. It came from a trip to Greece. It came from my wedding. I've been keeping it for a special occasion forever. And of course, no occasion is ever special enough. When should I open it? We got that letter literally every day, and we always wrote back the same thing. Open it Saturday night. Saturday night is the perfect moment for it. Celebrate the bottle. Celebrate the memories. Forget about the liquid. Celebrate what's really important about the bottle. We realized that was so difficult for most people to do that at some point we finally said, tell you what, let's have Open That Bottle Night, where all of us worldwide will open up that bottle that's just too special to open. And the response to that was unbelievable. We figured a few people would join us because, after all, when you think about it, everybody does have that bottle. Whether you've got one bottle in the house or 1,000 bottles in the house, there's that one bottle that has such special memories that you can never stand to open it. That first year, it was unbelievable. First, we got 2 or 3 letters, and I said to Dottie, oh, how sweet, we got 2 or 3 letters. This was back in the old days where people actually had to write letters and put stamps on them. And then, before you know it, they started coming in droves. You know that scene in Miracle on 34th Street where they walk in with the bags full of mail? It was like that. People literally all over the world telling us stories. We were laughing. We were crying. And so we decided we'd make it an annual event, and now we're coming up on the 10th one.
Well, I think this is a great time to have a good excuse for pleasure. For some of us, it's been a very long winter, and for most Americans, money is so tight. I mean, it's a hard time. And this doesn't have to be a fancy, schmancy, prestigious bottle of wine in order to do Open That Bottle Night.
It just needs to be something that has some significance for you.
Exactly right. And it's not about the liquid. It's about the memories.
Now, I have a confession here. We had one of our famous 6.5-minute Fresh Air Office birthday parties recently. And we had a bottle of cheap sparkling wine. And the cork hardly popped. The sparkling wine had no sparkle. And the sparkling wine probably would have been better on a salad than in a wine glass. So is this the risk you run into when you save wine for too long, even when it's good wine and not the cheap stuff that we were drinking?
It is. Wines are meant to be opened and enjoyed. And, you know, when you hold on to them for too long, sometimes they're not so good. We do hear from people every year who open something and it's dead. It's been dead for a while. So we urge people, if they have a bottle that they think might be fragile or in that condition, to have a backup bottle.
But last time we were on your show, actually, we heard from a lot of people who we'd never heard from before. And one of the questions came from a very nice woman in Colorado who wrote to say that she had a 12-year-old bottle of Martini and Rossi Asti Spumante. And she asked, is it safe to consume? Now, if you have to ask if a bottle is safe to consume, you've kept it too long.
If you are drinking a very old bottle of special wine, are you going to run into problems with the cork? Do you have to be really careful about how to uncork it?
You know, we think that those old fragile corks should be opened with the opener that has two prongs. And we recommend that people practice a few days before open that bottle night to get the hang of it.
But practice on what?
On a regular new bottle.
Oh, I
something,
see. Okay.
Something more recent.
And then you'll have to drink it after you practice on it,
unfortunately.
Yeah.
Darn. But if the cork does fall apart, you want to have a coffee filter around so that then you can pour the wine with the cork fragments into that so that you can separate that and drink the good stuff.
Why do you think it's so hard for so many people to actually open and drink the bottle of wine that they've been putting aside for that special occasion?
Well, we have a bottle that falls into that category, and we bought it at a winery in California. It's a Cinso. It's a Rhone varietal that was made by Bill Frick and his wife, Judith. And we spent a few hours with them, and they were lovely people, and she was an artist, and her work was all over the winery's walls. And a few years later, Bill called us and said that Judith had died. And we went back a few years later to see him, and he was visiting his kids. But we held on to that bottle, and it's just sort of hard for us to part with it.
Right. I mean, you get a bottle like that, and the problem is that after you save it the first few months because it's so special, then it's kind of like you keep looking at it and saying, well, maybe tonight's the night to open it. Not special enough. Not special enough. And literally, with each passing day, each passing month, and each passing year, the occasion always has to be too special. And as a result, you never open it up.
So when did you drink that bottle?
We haven't yet.
It may be our bottle for open that bottle night this very year.
It's a candidate for this year.
Right.
And, you know, we've had it a long time. We heard from a mother who bought a case of Italian wine when her son was born, and she planned to serve it at his wedding. And she wrote to us that he's now in his 30s, and he's not even dating. So she's going to drink those wines herself.
What are some of your other favorite stories about Open That Bottle Night?
Well, personally, one of my all-time favorites actually happened our very first year, and it really sums up so much of what Open That Bottle Night is about. It came from a guy named Mario Ruiz from South Florida. For Open That Bottle Night, he and his wife decided that they would have a special pizza. It's the pizza that they fell in love with their prize bottle of 1986 Chateau Latour, which is a great wine. It's not the sort of thing you'd normally have with pizza, but they went on an hour and 15 round trip to their special pizza place, brought the pizza back, and opened up their 1986 Latour. And Mr. Ruiz wrote to us, the pizza was great. The Chateau Latour was good, not great, but it got better toward the end of our meal and much better as we entered the jacuzzi with Mr. Barry White in the background.
Very nice.
it's stuff like that. It's like some like that make us laugh and some make us cry.
We also heard from John Watson that first year, and he said, if only you'd invented Open That Bottle Night a year earlier, my bride of 50 years would have been here in person instead of just in spirit to enjoy this gift of the grape. And then we heard a few years later from John Watson that he'd met Mary, an American, while they were both on holiday in France. And we thought, that sounds interesting. And then a few years later, we heard that John was visiting Mary on the West Coast, and they celebrated Open That Bottle Night looking at the Pacific. And then a couple years ago, we got a letter and a picture from John's kids, including a picture from John and Mary's wedding. So we've gone through the whole life cycle with this gentleman and Mary. And it all has to do with wine. It's just sweet.
Those are really nice stories. I just want to acknowledge, as we're talking about the beautiful powers of a good bottle of wine, that a lot of our listeners probably don't drink for various reasons. And so for those of you, I hope you have something that you really enjoy that you can savor and savor with friends or family on Open That Bottle Night if you so choose.
Well, it doesn't have to be wine. Wine isn't the point. You know, it's nice if it's wine, but it doesn't have to be. It's just getting people together. You can have fruit punch, you know, and just share your life with someone.
Dorothy Gator, John Brecher, happy Open That Bottle Night, and thanks for coming back to Fresh Air. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you.
John Brecher and Dorothy Gator write the Wall Street Journal's wine column, Tastings. The 10th anniversary of Open That Bottle Night is this Saturday. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.